Maureen McCloy was born in Des Moines, Iowa, and returned to her home state to go to the Iowa Writers' Workshop many years later. At Iowa, she began her first novel, Walking After Midnight, and by the time it was published in 1985, she had won the Michener Fellowship and offered the Stegner Fellowship and was a fellow at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, where she lived for the next 4 years, writing her second novel, Summertime, which was published again by Poseidon, Simon & Schuster last year, and is about to be a Hallmark Hall of Fame special, and is coming out in paperback this week. Among the people who have sung her praises are Ann Tyler and Richard Yates and Barry Hanna, and I expect you'll find yourselves in that group after tonight. Here she is.
Thank you all for coming. I'm really pleased to be here. This is my first venture into Maine, so tomorrow I get to see the ocean from this perspective. I'm going to read from the book Summertime tonight, just starting at the beginning and reading chapter one, and then I'll skip on a little farther into the book. For the second time in a week, the couple stood in church asking to be married. Now on Friday, the Reverend Thomas Lighton could comply, praise be to Jesus. On Monday, there had been a legal snag. You need blood tests, he had said. I'm sorry. The woman was quick to declare, we're in perfect health. She tapped her wrist with two long white fingers, and the minister, a usually unflappable counselor to his congregation, could have kicked himself for going tongue-tied and evasive. He fumbled in his pocket for a breath mint and peeled back the paper with care, offering the little roll to his visitors, who declined. He wished that the venereal exam could be waived for the prospective bride and groom in their 80s. It's for the record, he had said neutrally, a law for quite some time. Mr. Hazen Batten and his future wife predated Social Security cards, world wars, and mandatory driver's licenses. The minister knew that Jessamine Morrow, having been Mrs. Lawrence Mitchell Morrow for 63 years, had attended the Methodist Church forever, first in rural Iowa back in the days when Methodists disapproved of dancing in the movies, and for decades here in Des Moines. Let a gum-chewing official, not her church, bring her up to date. The courthouse will issue a license, he told her. Now for the second marriage attempt, the future Mrs. Hazen Batten withdrew the certificates from a stiff black pocketbook. The ceremony proceeded. The three people clustered in a side chapel which smelled of summer morning, slightly dewy. The future Mrs. Batten was trim in pink shirtwaist and complimentary rouge cheeks. She arched an eyebrow and gazed beyond the minister, out of the church. Far away from the present, he felt, but whether to past or future, Reverend Lighton could not guess. He did not suggest that the couple remain standing for his blessing. They seemed to accept being seated as part of the luxury inherent in a late-life marriage. The bride-to-be fitted her pocketbook on her lap like a shield and looked neither left nor right. The old groom's body sloped to one side. Silver hair was slicked back over the ears. His eyes, made childishly round by his glasses, would not leave the minister's face. He could be deaf, reading lips, Reverend Lighton thought as he turned to the marriage litany. He began by invoking God's grace for a prosperous marriage. He cut out the word long rather than cause distress. He sounded the till death do us part with ringing finality. For once, as he stood before a couple taking vows, he knew the intent and outcome of the union, the truthfulness of a marriage. Afterward, he followed the couple outside. We thank you, Mrs. Batten said. I thank you, he said. Mrs. Batten linked arms with her husband and pulled away from the minister. She was sure-footed and tastefully bejeweled. You would not expect her to be so old, the minister thought. 85? You would not want to imagine her wedding night, and he quickly invoked God's guidance lest he do so. The two approached a boat of a car, and Mrs. Batten waited, smiling now at that distant point again, while her husband opened the door for her. Then Hazen Batten made his way back to the driver's side. He gunned the engine alarmingly and jerked into gear, but immediately became a very slow driver, inching from the curb. Mrs. Batten seemed to remember something. She turned to the minister and waved a white-gloved hand. She smiled and looked girlish, mischievous, daring. Marriage at her age, she knew, was a scandal no matter how you did it. Are you turning around, Hazen? The car seemed to be nosing, then hesitating at an angle toward a pancake house parking lot. not entirely in the drive, but off the road. Just trying to get her out of town, Jessamine. Now don't you worry, we're going to get ourselves south. Jessamine looked around to find the sun and south. The plastic covering of Hazen's car seat creaked when she shifted her weight. By design, there were specks of glitter embedded under the plastic. She expected that Hazen knew where they were going, all right. Hazen laughed, and the car bucked itself back onto the road. Jessamine liked Hazen's laugh, deep and generous, with a wheeze at the end. At Hillcrest Retirement Center, he had played a practical joke on her to get her attention in the first place. He plugged in a tree ornament that made bird chirping sounds. When Jessamine cried, "There's a sparrow loose in here," Hazen had laughed forever. Lawrence Mitchell Morrow had laughed for decades, Jessamine recalled. Bless his soul. Hazen drove, and Jessamine held the map as if she were navigating, but this too she left to Hazen. Some late suburban and ramshackle acreages, a final horrid furniture warehouse fell away, and they were traveling in the sweet July countryside. After the Hillcrest reception and presentation, his and hers towel set, after changing reluctantly out of the pink shirtwaist into her good pantsuit, Jessamine was Mrs. Hazen Batten, settled alongside her husband, who was gallantly driving to the southernmost tip of the state to fulfill her dream, returning to her girlhood home finally at leisure. They would have to drive for hours and hours, she expected. The original Walnut Grove had been nothing more than a farm crossroads even in her day. Landmarks would be scarce. Even the trees would have grown to unfamiliarity. But home would consist of a fragrance in the air and an understanding of the lay of the land, no matter what they had growing on it, Jessamine was convinced. She had spent a few girlhood years in Leroy, a little town near Walnut Grove. She and Hazen would make Leroy their destination, register at the good hotel, and venture out by day. She was used to traveling only as far south as Mineola, 20 miles from Des Moines, her present home. She and Lawrence had begun their lives together in Mineola years ago. James Lawrence was born and raised there, but post-Depression hardship forced them to move to the city, to Des Moines. Then it had never seemed right to ask Lawrence to take her all the way down to Walnut Grove and Leroy just for a look around, and after a time he hadn't known leisure at all. One evening, 5 years ago, he had lain down with no more than a sniffle and died. He had not lived to see their own James Lawrence taken from this earth in midlife. But the trip with Hazen now made for the perfect event. Here he sat, driving her south. "Heck, Jessamine," he had said, "I know Iowa like the back of my hand. We're off." Row after row, fields and fields of corn reached golden to the sun and waved happily, just for Jessamine's inspection. She expected they waved due south and guided her home. The superhighway could not hold her attention. The bleatings of big trucks, and the sudden sound of gravel spraying the car as Hazen swerved on and off the shoulder were minor obstacles to the glory of the ride. Jessamine compared her marriage to the road. It reached in both directions, for the moment taking her straight back to childhood, and, she hoped, leading onward until her death. Jessamine watched Hazen drive and imagined him as a dairy farmer commandeering milk wagons, hoisting heavy cans. He had put up his own home, too, and claimed never to have taken sick. He swore he had never swallowed a pill. She had her hunches. Hazen would be with her until the end. Now Hazen was off the road on purpose, slowed, winding down a narrow ramp where bright purple ditchweed grew along the shoulder. "Got to wet the whistle," he said, pulling into a gasoline and quick store combination affair, the name of which was frankly distasteful to Jessamine. "Bye and bye-bye," said the big red letters, printed at a slant, with streaks out the left side to show just how fast would be the buying. This was not the case with Hazen, though. Jessamine could see him walking up and down the three aisles many times, an amiable look put to the magazines and whatnot. She rolled down her window. The wind must have shifted, a fragrance that made her feel she was burying her face in the sweetest green pea patch engulfed her. Her mouth watered, and she swallowed several times. She stretched her head clear out the window. Alfalfa, it had to be. In late afternoon, all sensation deepened and thickened in the simmering day. Sun would be sinking by the time they reached Walnut Grove, but to Jessamine, it seemed they had all the time in the world. They were not of the bye and bye-bye era or philosophy, and she looked with pride upon her new husband, who was still ambling within the store, now passing some huge refrigerator cases. Jessamine smelled the alfalfa and used the outside rearview mirror instead of her compact to repair herself. "Mrs. Hazen Batten," she said, adjusting one red button earring. "I got this kitty drink, Jessamine," Hazen said, getting into the car. He smiled behind a large bottle of grape soda pop. "They're out of the real juice, I guess." Hazen drank and then handed the bottle to Jessamine. "Fella says go east over to Weldon and you're straight on to Leroy." Hazen followed the instructions, and when he turned off the superhighway for good, Jessamine felt a sense of homecoming stronger than ever. The sun was turning to fire, and she had trouble staying put on the creaking seat. The spangles became luminous in the intense low light. For Hazen, the wide flatlands of the north would have the feel of home to them, but this was Jessamine's turf, these rolling hills and the much smaller farms. In her day, the folks around Walnut Grove believed that any farm exceeding 100 acres was a sign of greed. The road curled around on itself, sometimes fooling Hazen, who barreled along ditches and fence posts, getting the feel of this new surface. The sun dropped behind a high hill, making the outline of corn on sky a spiky, stylized sort of picture. The horizon glowed pink. Way up to the heavens it spread, the color of a baby's cheek. "Down here we say roasting ears," Jessamine remembered emphatically. "Not sweet corn or corn on the cob, Hazen." She chuckled, and Hazen chuckled too. He could not help but drive in a randy sort of way. Years dropped like the sun behind the hills. Hazen Batten was honeymooning, escorting his bride on adventure. They pulled into Leroy, a town of few streetlights. Jessamine waved Hazen toward the Bancroft Hotel, a massive front of red brick and gargoyles, with a great tea room which all travelers used to visit, right across from her uncle's old livery stable. And there was one of the terrible buy and bye-bye stores instead. "Gracious," Jessamine exclaimed, "the hotel is missing." Hazen could have predicted this. Through the years, he had continued to cruise the countryside, returning to remote and lovely spots he had known on milk routes and pleasure runs, yearly watching progress obliterate his past. He had hoped for Jessamine's sake that the old hotel would be there in its glory for their honeymoon, but he loved her perplexity and his own calm. "Don't you worry," he told Jessamine. He took her hand in his and squeezed, feeling authority in the new wedding band and the moisture from the grape soda bottle. The world was a vast, dark shape, and he and Jessamine were alone together in this one patch of blazing electrical light. And, despite his high notions, Hazen's head drooped. Jessamine could see that, though Hazen was trying to protect her from the harshness of change, they had to get settled quickly. He snored before she fully understood he had dozed off. "Wait here, dear," she told her sleepy husband. And with her light walk, pantsuit jacket open casually, Jessamine entered a quick shop for the first time in her life. She gasped as the doorbell sang out, announcing the occasion. "Oh," she said, and touched her throat. A man stooped over paper coffee cup and loud magazine eyed her. "We're looking for the hotel, Leroy's Hotel," she said. He shook his head. "No hotel." "No, there must be a hotel." She looked down the aisle. Not a thing in the store was sold unboxed, it seemed. "Motel," the man said. "Go 2 mile on down the country road. 2 mile, hang right at the sign, Magnolia Court." Jessamine rehearsed the directions carefully. Outside, the cicadas had begun poking 1,000 tiny screams into the night. Gently, Jessamine woke Hazen to explain. The Magnolia Court woman could have been the sister of the quick store man, the way she gave Jessamine and Hazen the once-over with disgust. They were intrinsically dull newcomers. At one time, everyone in these parts was related, of course, but Jessamine did not feel like inquiring after family trees for these two. Even if they were related, they felt like people she didn't want to know lived in Leroy or Walnut Grove. She was contemplating the family ties and economic connections of the old days, her grandfather Stanley's orchard thrown open to charity cases for a day of apple picking, the aroma of fruit in the air, when the woman stepped back from unlocking the door. Hazen's arm slipped around Jessamine's waist and propelled her into the motel room. The rush of motion and a glimpse of the room's turquoise motif frightened Jessamine back to the present, the honeymoon, a motel room. Though she loved this man Hazen dearly, it was the hand of a stranger holding hers now as he helped her to a sitting position on the bed. A strange bed. She had never slept in a strange bed. She had taken a family bed to her marriage. Her first marriage, she had to say now. The mottled pudginess of Hazen's fingers reminded Jessamine of good pork links on the countertop thawing. His were gentle hands, and though Hazen had nodded to sleep moments earlier, he was wide awake now, ceremonious, and without words exchanged, he understood her sudden fluster. The sausage fingers worked to comfort her. "You may use the bathroom, dear," he said. He stood back, holding Jessamine's hands, urging her to rise. She stood and nodded. Jessamine did not look at herself once as she carefully stepped out of her pantsuit. She wondered instead if the aqua shower curtain with gold thread glitter running through it was supposed to represent a water scene or modern art. There were no hangers in the bathroom, and she couldn't go back out now. She wouldn't call to Hazen, so she folded the clothes, underthings tucked inside the jacket, on the back of the toilet. Now, she had never worn much green, but she next removed from her bag a light green summer gown, the color of spring and mint. Beige lace bordered the bodice. Jessamine tied the string belt securely through the waist. She looked down at the gown and her feet, still in knee-high flesh-tone hosiery. She rolled the stockings down and off quickly and stuffed them into her jacket pocket. Once the matching bed jacket was draped over her shoulders, she acknowledged the mirror. Jessamine looked back at herself the same way as always, with the secret expression that apparently eluded the rest of the world. No matter how often she compared, say, the portrait done of her at age 8 by the traveling Jewish photographer with her 50th anniversary photo, or with her look right this minute, she saw the same person, beyond hairstyle and the rest, the ageless spirit, she guessed, a young, unchanging Jessamine. Yesterday, she had dropped a letter to Alice Morrow through the local slot there in the post office lobby. Across town today, her daughter-in-law would be sitting at her desk reading the wedding announcement, stopped in her work, the nature of which Jessamine could not satisfactorily explain to herself, knowing only that since the death of dear James Lawrence, Allie's job had seemed to take on career proportions. And the letter to granddaughter Carla that must travel many miles, past fields and towns, clear over to the Mississippi and deep into a woodland known to her only through tale-telling and photographs, this letter she had double-stamped and marked airmail over the postal clerk's objection. She knew the letters would arrive simultaneously as she wished. "Mrs. Hazen Batten," she told the mirror and her family. She touched up her lipstick, then blotted it carefully. This might not be the right thing to do, but what was? Hazen, the man, should know best, she assured herself, and that imparted some confidence to her hesitant glance at the doorknob. And Hazen did know. Quickly, he had changed out of his traveling clothes. It wouldn't do to be caught, well, with his pants down. Generally, women took their sweet time with fussing, but Jessamine was swift and sure in other ways and might suddenly burst from the bathroom. He couldn't hear much going on in there. He hurried into sky blue cotton pajamas, still creased where the cardboard had wrapped them. He tied on a thin robe. What else? He moved quickly to see that the lamp with gold flowers on the shade worked. This meant he could turn off the overhead. He pulled back the spread and covers clumsily, then tried to smooth down the sheets. He sat on the bed, then stood up. He should be standing when she came through that door. There was no basin in this room, so he looked in the mirror and tried to press his hair to his head. He had forgotten about the existence of combs altogether. He pressed and pressed, and doing this, he heard the bathroom door open. He nearly fell. He caught himself on the back of the one chair in the place, some sort of canvas slingback jobby. His legs were goners. Could a heart attack start in the knees? Lopsidedly, holding the chair, he turned and saw Jessamine shrouded in beautiful, soothing light green. She shimmered in the low light he had arranged. Knowing that he had helped create this flattery, Hazen swelled with pride. "You're a beauty," he said. "Why, yes, sir, Jessamine." And Hazen's laugh, as quick and uneven sounding as the gravel hitting the car whenever he had veered a bit on the shoulder, broke tension. There was no question at all but to glide straight into Hazen's big dairyman's arms. Soft robes and wishes cast the spell. In bed, Hazen hugged Jessamine to him tightly. She could not distinguish between their heartbeats, and she took this as a sign that they had all the time in the world to think up and down their bodies and marvel in the sensation of feeling as one. Okay. Yeah. Excuse me. So these two people and various others kind of gallop along through the book. And I'll pick up again with Hazen and Jessamine after the honeymoon is over, whether matrimonial or not. Of course, daily life always enters in. As usual, Hazen awoke with the sun and Jessamine did not. She felt his kiss, a tickle on the cheek that ran a skittering sensation up the bone to her temple. As Hazen squeezed her hand under the sheet and rolled himself to sitting, she continued to let her head rest very still on the heirloom embroidered pillowcase. Hazen's feet swam themselves into his slippers and off he went. Through the wall that separated bedroom from bath, Jessamine followed Hazen's morning preparations. First he gargled, then a little cough accompanied the fitting of his bridge to mouth. When he stirred up his shaving cream in the old spice cup she had given him, the attendant low drone meant he was humming. Hazen progressed to morning chores. He could be expected to empty the trash can into the hall dumpster if as much as one tissue had been discarded into it. Next, he checked the little refrigerator. From the sound of it, the ice cubes she had frozen last night didn't suit Hazen's idea of proper ice cubes. Perhaps they had set lopsidedly or were too shallow. He moved back toward the bathroom, where he cracked the tray against the sink, then ran water to refill it. While Hazen walked down the hall to the landing window for a clear view of sky and field, the condition of which he would report to her later, Jessamine put on her robe and went to the bathroom. Hazen's leather shaving bag and his tortoiseshell comb, the old spice cup and toothbrush, medium bristled to her soft, became a meditative presence by which to work on herself. Lilac soap bar was lathered, the face massaged, the toweling dry undertaken with care. Back to the dressing table, now powder, now lipstick. Cologne was dabbed on the throat. "Light clouds," Hazen called. All set, Jessamine moved into the front room and was sorry to find that Hazen had put on the shirt from last night's dinner. She prayed quickly to the black-clad ancestor ovals on the east wall, "In due time, and this too shall pass." Early in their acquaintanceship, Jessamine had confided in Hazen after breakfast, "Some of these people look like they've tumbled from bed and landed directly in the dining room." Her heart warmed with Hazen's mordancy. "Yes, Deborah ought to put mirrors at the tables instead of her darn centerpieces," he said. "Wouldn't that fix them, losing their appetites over their own looks?" Now she waited for Hazen to look away from the morning variety show to notice her. Finally, "Jess, you're ready for the dance." Jessamine smoothed at her no-wrinkle shirtwaist. Hazen flustered her pleasurably with the nickname she had abhorred in girlhood, Jessie, a woman without a bustle who could use some restraint back there. Jess, a boy's name. She went to Hazen with her arms extended, two bracelets jangling from the left wrist. He clasped them silent and tugged once, firmly but lightly, as if signaling a trolley stop. By now the sausage fingers were familiar as church. He leaned her against his side so that she half sat on his lap. His legs, Jessamine was proud to note, were perfectly capable when at rest, and hers were slim as a girl's. "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen." Deborah's voice pushed its way through the loudspeaker and bounced all over the carpet, sprang up and spanked the walls and tremored Jessamine's earrings. The air became metallic, Jessamine swore. "Breakfast today is poached eggs and wheat toast or bran flakes, sticky bun, a fruit selection and juice. It's 7:45, breakfast time." "We're not deaf," Jessamine cried, though turned away from the speaker. "My dear." She sighed and motioned Hazen to stand. She wished to be granted just one day in which to cook for him. At sunup, she would tie an apron to her waist and stuff a turkey to bursting with her oyster dressing, baste it in sweet butter, and roast it all day. Then right before the company came, a load of company, and after adding the relishes and the flatware to the table, she would change into her smooth black skirt and the white silk blouse with pleated yoke bodice and glass buttons down the front. Yes, she would. "Let's get along now, Hazen," she said. Jessamine and Hazen were early birds in the serving line. Side by side, they carried their trays to the table for two they occupied near the front of the dining hall, a distinction afforded them as a married couple. This was the walk Jessamine adored. She shuddered, recalling her routine of 5 years as a woman alone at Hillcrest. The blabby Margaret Jennings had been assigned her former table, and a shrill Easterner had been led into Hillcrest, who had been led into Hillcrest sat there too. Generally, a good class of people resided at Hillcrest, but to eat three meals a day with the same six meant that having even one bad apple at the table devastated the peace. The situation had anguished her to no end, yet she had perfected the inward path of anger that allowed her to sit in a full room, furious to death at the woman to her left, with none the wiser. Mm-hmm. Though the eggs required little effort, Hazen winged his elbows in order to eat. "Ah," he said when finished. He pushed his plate forward and took his coffee black. Jessamine paused and looked across the table at Hazen. She easily imagined her old light-filled kitchen into being, despite the stark fluorescence etching him. Daylight had spilled onto her spick-and-span floor tiles in a room rimmed with checked curtains and seasonal fragrance. The table was set with English blue willow and cloth napkins. A memory of unbounded privacy warded off the Hillcrest stares and speculations, always whispering along her spine. Hazen said, "Ah," again, and with his eyeglasses flashing in the fake morning light, he announced, "I've been thinking. There's only about one thing in the world I guess I can say I've got over on you, Jess. Want to guess at it? I'll give you a hint. It doesn't have a darn thing to do with your hand-painted dishes or whatnot." Jessamine sipped coffee and prepared for the game. "Let's see," she said. As a lifelong farmer, Hazen was rightly energetic and fanciful at the breakfast hour. "You've had your travels. I expect you know the roads north and south and everywhere. I've always meant to visit my people in California, and I believe you could drive me there, Hazen, or even to Alaska, if you put your mind to it. And I'll say that because you're a man, you've had certain experiences pertaining to earning a living that qualify you to speak on a range of subjects." Her glistening coffee reflected the cagey cheer Jessamine felt at such times. She worked to educate Hazen through photo album sessions and examination of family artifacts. In turn, Hazen, a man of few possessions, used the guessing game to shore up his past. From his broad declarations, Jessamine proceeded to glean the stuff of his days and then educate him further. Smiling, she jangled her bracelets and waited. "Can't guess? I give up, Hazen." "I have great grandkids. We're 4-0 on that score, Jess. Being on top of four generations, that should make me feel old as Moses, wouldn't you think? But darn, if it doesn't make me think of all the good times. I want to touch their fat, happy elbows and such. Wouldn't you like them to visit? We'd have a real party." Hazen looked around the room and let his voice deepen. "Bunch of old croakers." And some people were staring back at Hazen as if accusing him of the very same thing. "Hazen." Jessamine sought a whisper with backbone. "It's only breakfast, and most folks haven't reached stride yet. Will you listen to me? Don't glower at them. Great-grandchildren? Why, you act like you've just realized the extent of your family." Jessamine pushed forward at the bust. "We've been over this ground before. Yes, those children live in Kansas. I can name them Crystal and Robin, Matthew and Justin. You see, I really don't count this as having something over on a person. We're hardly in control of such events. Battens are like oxen. That's what they used to say about battens. You know, same as a dairy herd. Something gets passed down the line, on and on. You can't stop the battens, it was always said." The purple plastic African violets between their plates were safer and not as sad to look at as Hazen. How often through the years had she waited, at first confidently, Jessamine recalled, then in prayer, for news from the river, a baby, Carla and Brian expecting. She had stopped alluding to her hopes quite some time ago. How fragile the universe of morrows. Once a cavalcade of pioneers matched with stout Stanley blood, the generations had winnowed the family. Morrows had become few. Allie was left with a name, and only Carla carried the blood. Hazen, breakfast is over. Uh-oh, Jess, are you huffing up on me? I didn't mean to get your goat. It's a curiosity, that's all, and a fact, like horses eat hay. Jessamine made sure to keep smiling as she stood. They took the elevator up to 2. With both hands, Jessamine clasped her beaded coin pouch, which contained the room key, and sometimes her fingers would snap up stiffly, snap down as fast, giving the impression that the pouch's contents wished to speak. She watched the number on the wall light up from 1 to 2. She walked down the hallway with her arm crooked automatically for Hazen, while her heart tumbled back over itself in memory, seeking Lawrence Mitchell Morrow. How he had rejoiced at the birth of his granddaughter, Carla. He had pronounced the name as if speaking through rich chocolate. So, when everyone gets to heaven, then what? She'd like to know. But silly. Couples and what all were earthly matters. Some high order of society would be heaven. And up there, she thought, you would behave like a bird more than anything. Glorious and tropical, traveling in arcs and spirals and dives, breathing lavender, then soaring on to the zenith of fragrance, more soothing than sleep. Lawrence Mitchell Morrow would not spite her the Hazen marriage, not in heaven. Besides, she planned to beat Hazen to it, and all would be smoothed over by the time he arrived. Our father, I wish to die a married lady, Jessamine reiterated. Her heels echoed smartly, and Hazen's shoes made a scooting sound. Stubborn as a dray horse, that was Hazen, and she'd be the last person ever to suggest he use a walker. Jessamine's nose stung from the chemical solution fuming out of the beauty salon at the far end of the hall, and she wished, as she had never wished before marrying Hazen, that Hillcrest would all go away. She wished they could walk into their rooms, shut the door behind them, and be assured of ultimate privacy and loads of space. Let her entertain Hazen in a proper home, and she would know exactly who Hazen was. Banish loudspeakers. Never again admit a Margaret Jennings past the threshold. Install a rear door that leads to your very own fenced backyard and a discovery of fruit-bearing trees, good sour cherries begging to fill a pie. Lawrence, her heart called. Oh, James Lawrence. Hazen resumed watching the morning show. A girl dressed in leopard spots swiveled to point at the guest who wore a turban. He drew his legs up under him and raised his dark hands. He was barefoot on TV. The girl's shoulder was naked. Both looked directly into the Hillcrest living room where Jessamine now dusted. As she moved from the majolica plate to the hand-painted cup and saucer given her as a child, she feared to think that her cheerful granddaughter Carla had inherited a wartime malady from James Lawrence. World War II devastated James Lawrence's very blood. Could the Japanese have finished off the Morrows, robbed Carla of motherhood? She must speak to Allie, to Reverend Lighton, to her physician. She had never understood that disease. Jessamine set down the duster and dropped quietly into a plush wingback chair. She was out of energy, thanks to the Japanese. Seeing that Hazen's morning nap was in progress, she let herself weep. Thank you.